Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Show Me the Way podcast. And today, this is episode 15, From Employee to President to Advisor. In this episode, we talk with Aggie Cooper of Tarsus, CFO, and her experiences from banker to executive consultant for business owners. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain, LLP, about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I am your host, Dave Sider. And joining me today on our show is Aggie Cooper, and I have known Aggie a very long time. Yeah, I guess I have. I've known her for over 25 years. I guess that was back when you were in grade school. I'm going to go with that for a moment. Aggie's of Kansas City, who's been engaged in helping various businesses at all levels, including helping her clients and business owners with the exits of their business. Aggie is going to share some of her secrets to successfully growing a business and seeking an exit from the company. Aggie, welcome to the show. And this is so much fun because Aggie and I have spent time after time after time, our own time, staying in touch with one another. It's good to talk to you, Aggie. Thanks for joining us.
No, it's great to be here. I'm flattered that you asked me to join. I was actually, and I will say, I don't have any secret sauce, Dave. I have things that I've learned. I've had things that I've learned from a lot of people along the way, from entrepreneurs to executive team members to people on the plant floor, as well as the Tarsus team. So I'm more than happy to impart any information or thoughts that I think, well, those are things that were repeated. That's a systemic thing I came across or a systemic thing we needed to do. So happy to visit about some of those.
Looking forward to it. Thank you. Share with us a little bit of your personal history. What is Aggie Cooper all about? Where were you born?
I was born in Omaha, Nebraska.
Lovely town.
And I know you know. My family moved here, however, when I was in grade school, and thus I've effectively been a Kansas City native. You know, graduated from high school, went off to Avila University here in town when it was actually Avila College, not a university. I'm now on the board of that university. And again, as you mentioned, I started in banking on the commercial lending side. Spent several years there, learning from really great people, some days more frustrating than others. And then I had a customer walk in one day and say, hey, I have a manufacturing company and we're about $25 million and I want to begin to retire. So I'd like to bring you in as my controller and you can work with the team. And we ultimately grew that company to not quite $70 million. Over about 8 years, I ended up being their president before we sold. But it was a lot of fun. I spent 10 years traveling back and forth to Manhattan, New York on that project.
Not a bad gig. So you worked for a bank. Did you start at entry level? I mean, how did it get you from the position that somebody walks in and goes, Aggie, come and work for me or with me?
I actually started, it was through the work program when I was in high school. I worked at the bank. I started as a commercial teller when they still had them. Started as a commercial teller.
Now, you know there's a whole generation of people that have no idea.
No idea what I just about. Said. I know. But I started as a commercial teller, and I worked 7 years there while I was going to night school to get my degree. And through that period, I learned, you know, credit documentation, and I became a vice president of commercial lending, did a lot of work with our international letters of credit. And this particular client needed a lot of international letter of credit work to handle his business. And yeah, we just worked together very closely for a long time.
So you started with this company as a manufacturing company of sorts. Sounds like domestic, international sales. So you're asked to come into a company and you've come out of banking. It doesn't sound like you've had a background in manufacturing. What caused you to think you could make that jump? There had to have been something in you.
It's funny that you would ask that, because I was actually at lunch a couple of weeks ago with someone who asked me my journey, and I gave him the 5-minute elevator spiel. So clearly we were going, I don't know, for 5 minutes, that must have been 182nd floor. But I gave him the 5-minute speech, and he said to me, so what I'm hearing you say is that when someone asks you to do something and you hadn't done it before, instead of being intimidated by it, you said, yeah, I'm on board. And it took me from Manhattan, New York, to Central America, to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It never was in me to say, no, I don't want to try that experience.
So through this experience, you helped this company grow from, as you said, 25 million to around 70 million. How did you achieve that? And I assume, knowing you, it wasn't by yourself, so I don't mean it that way. But what did you do? What did the company do once you came on board to get to that level of success?
There were two entrepreneurs. One was here and one was in Manhattan. The one here was truly a typical entrepreneur, which you'll hear me say that phrase a lot of times. By the time we figured out how to do the first dot of his plan, he'd already gone 3 more dots down, or 4 more dots down. And some days it was kind of an interesting debate to explain to him, okay, but we can only properly execute 2.5 dots, and now you're on dot 4. So we've got to make some choices here. We have to prioritize what you want this company to look like and where you want it to go. He did have someone that at the time I didn't understand why he chose this person as a partner. I just didn't get it, because they were so different. But that's why it worked. That's absolutely why it worked.
That is the yin and the yang.
Yeah, one was a hunter and the other one was an executor, and that's just how we got it done.
So you said this person or these persons are an entrepreneur. Is your definition of an entrepreneur in 2022 different than when you were working at a bank at the beginning of your journey, or is it about the same? Has it evolved?
It's evolved. It's definitely evolved. And I don't know if the definition of an entrepreneur has evolved in so much as my exposure to the entrepreneurial world. And, you know, there's a group of entrepreneurs that don't, you know, they're happy with where they are and they don't want to grow the company beyond $25 million. There's a group of entrepreneurs who want to surround themselves with really, really, really smart people, but then maybe not listen to them because they don't like what they have to say. And then there's the group of entrepreneurs that surrounds themselves and listens to them. They listen, learn, and then they lead. And those are the groups that I've worked with that started at 30 million and ended up at 140 million.
So you've moved on from the first business, manufacturing business. What was the next business?
The next business was actually working for a family here in town that had multiple companies.
Okay.
And they had a company that actually manufactured apparel.
Okay.
And they had recently purchased plants in Central America, which was interesting, because we knew nothing about having plants in an international country, but that's okay. That was one of those times where I said, sure, the major partner that was here in Kansas City with the first group was cashing out. And I told him, I'll stay until you've cashed out. Mm-hmm. And then I'd like to take my next adventure. And my next adventure led me to apparel manufacturing in Honduras for 6 years.
And how did you like Honduras?
You know what? It was an adjustment to learn how they do business, how to do business, because it's just a lot different. It was just a lot different value system. The 98%, obviously, as we all know and have heard, are pretty much governed by the 2%. The 2% of the population when I was down there was evolving and changing, and it was very interesting to watch it, because in the 70s, when Saddam Hussein took control in Iraq, a lot of Iraqi parents took their kids out of Iraq and they moved to Central America. The only country, one of the few countries that would let non-citizens purchase land and start businesses was Honduras. So when I was down there, that generation of first generation Hondurans whose parents came from Iraq and had a ton of money still because they brought it with them, they send the kids off to Oxford to go get educated. The kids come back home to Honduras. Well, they planned on taking over Honduras. So it was interesting to watch that interaction dynamic, between that dynamic between the truly Spanish Hondurans and the first generation Iraqi Hondurans. And when I originally started at Avila University, I was an international poli sci major and I loved it. I met my husband who already had a child and he was never leaving Missouri. And I had no idea what I was going to do with an international poli sci major in Missouri. So I went to my counselor and I said, I've been at this 7 years. I don't want to be at it for another three. What's the other degree I can get with all these credits? And the rest is history. I became a finance major.
Wow. So after that business, so the first business, you were a CFO. Second business, you were a CFO again?
I was a president again, and I answered up to a group that collectively managed all the businesses.
Third business then?
The third business was I joined them because we sold all the plants in Honduras. It needed to happen. There were a lot of different dynamics down there. It needed to happen. The third business I joined because I had taken the summer off and got tired of running around and doing gardening. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to join a company that was in bankruptcy. Well, I had never taken a company out of bankruptcy or helped bring someone out of bankruptcy. So again, I thought, I'll give it a shot. I can learn a lot from that. I know I have a good financial background. I have a lot of experience in manufacturing. This too was a different twist on manufacturing. They brought in items and then they had retail stores that they sold them at, that they shipped them to. They had about 50 retail stores in 23 states and learned a lot about retail leasing and all of those sorts of great things that added to my knowledge base. What we didn't, you know, a lot of times, Dave, and we all know this, challenges work out. They just a lot of times don't work out on the path we thought they were going to work out on.
Right.
So the key is being flexible enough to say, okay, well, now what am I going to do with this information that landed in my office, and how am I going to work with the entrepreneur to figure out how to manipulate this language or this situation? What we didn't really expect was that we were bought off the courthouse steps by a group out of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And that in and of itself it was a fabulous experience, not without its challenges, but it was a very interesting experience. They had a lot of relationships with people in other countries like Germany and Spain and France. And it was so different, Dave, to work with every one of those cultures and try to get things done. It was just it was a truly fascinating experience. And again, I think I had a lot of international poli sci education. I really think it helped me. It helped me negotiate better and know I had to understand.
So it sounds to me like you climbed the ladder with three different companies. And in each situation, it sounds like you went through a process with them to help grow their companies. And those companies went in different directions. Needless to say, but you saw it through to the conclusion for each one. And at the end of the day, you're now out working for a company here locally as, should I say, a business consultant? How do you view yourself? What is your formal title?
Well, I'm a fractional CFO.
Okay.
And for Tarsus and the Tarsus clients. And I'll explain that in a minute. Or a lot of times it went in smaller entities, the CFO and the COO are combined. It's a combined mm-hmm. desk. Yeah. And I just have the background to be able to do that, to be able to do both sides of those. But Tarsus is a well-known group here in town that was started about 20 years ago. They've been serving, and I've been with them about 12 years now. They've been serving the small and emerging middle markets throughout the Midwest for that entire time. We provide, just as I said, fractional CFOs, fractional controllers, COOs, do a lot of different functions. When I say fractional, I mean I'm a company that maybe, and I'm making this up totally, I'm a company that has $30 million in revenue, and I know I need to go to the next level, or I want to go to the next level, but I cannot afford a full-time CFO. I just can't. So that's one of the things. When we say a fractional CFO, I've had several clients where I was in there. I'd go in 2 days a week, and after several months, I was in there 4 days a week. I've had clients I've gone with and started just to lead a project and help them lead a project. I've worked with companies to help with buy-side due diligence, which is always very, frankly, sometimes much more enjoyable than sell-side diligence.
Yes. On the sales side, I think a lot of people are trying to figure out, are they going to discover everything? And on the buy side, you're kind of like Columbus. You know, you're trying to find the brave new world, for lack of a better analogy.
And the benefit of having worked both sides of that is that on the buy side, we know where to go look
right.
for the skeletons right. in the closet.
Right.
So that, and you're right, there are several times, honestly, I can never think of a buy or sell time that I worked that things didn't come up and things that people didn't expect. And right. sometimes even Mr. Business Owner did not see that coming, did not realize that's how something was being handled, did not. Yeah. So, but I think the Tarsus team, again, we work on back office improvements, because you can't get better if you don't make changes and don't teach people things. We help with debt and equity financing. One of my very favorite things to do is go in and work with teams, executive teams or middle management teams, to look at what is the information you're looking at to make decisions. What are your KPIs? And getting information 45 days after a month end close is not really a KPI. I mean, it's not giving you, clearly you need to measure your performance, but you also need information that helps you make real-time decisions, be it every day, every other day, or every week. And the top should not be the only, top level of management should not be the only level getting KPIs. Maybe the KPIs are different, or maybe they're more enhanced, but your middle managers need to know.
For our audience listening in, what is a KPI? They may not know.
Key performance indicator.
Very good.
So if I want, so for example, our COO at the company that I most recently worked with, he tracked how many tons of corrugate went across that floor every day. We then began to say, okay, well, but what's our quality ratio? And then what's the underlying problem of the quality? Because it can't always be the plant floor's fault. I mean, we've got really good people on the plant floor too. How many times was there maybe a miscommunication on the design?
Right.
How many times? I mean, lots and lots and lots of different things. So the quality department in that case got beefed up. They were lean certified people, helped us a lot improve our relationships on the plant floor and between sales and the plant floor, which clearly always helps the financial side of the business. So it's not just a financial key performance indicator. It's a, how are we producing? How are our vendors doing?
Mm-hmm.
And vendors many times really dislike being forced to send a KPI.
Right.
But it becomes, you have to figure out a way to make it collaborative. Because if you're depending on three steps ahead of you before it hits our plant floor, we need to know where they are in those three steps.
I appreciate you going into that. No one has really shared at that level before. And, you know, that's even for me, that's very insightful. So
well,
thanks.
And the sales pipeline, you could get me started. This session will be 90 minutes. The sales pipeline, for example, what is in the pipeline, which normally sales teams have, but what's your close ratio?
Yep.
What are we spending our time on?
Absolutely.
You know, stuff like that. If you see a salesperson whose close ratio is struggling, how can we help you? What, you know, all those things. Yeah.
So you, a lot of lessons learned through this, right?
Yes.
And as I say to some people, and I don't know if it's an appropriate statement, that a lot of the journeys you go on, you're either having a General Sherman or a General Custer experience, and you just hope you're not going to get massacred, so to speak. So let's talk about the, and I'd say it this way, the General Custer experience. In other words, I don't believe people fail. I believe certain events fail, certain behaviors fail, but I don't think people fail as such, as long as you get back on the horse and get going. So tell me about some of the challenges, let's just use that word, if you would, that you had to deal with and maybe been eye-opening for you. Because I often find, and I learned this through Dan Sullivan, the strategic coach, that success is a sedative. And I think it confuses people. You learn more from those failures than you do anything else. Is there anything that you could share with us that would be helpful to the audience?
Well, one of my very favorite quotes, who I believe is from Winston Churchill, is the greater glory is not in never falling. It is getting up every time we fall.
Right, right.
So, you know, if I have to think back about what have I really loved about the last 30 years of my career, it is the times that my eyebrows have been burned off.
Right.
In an odd sort of way, you know, real leaders lead. And when things get that stressful and that tough, the team is looking to the leader, not only for the reaction, but also guidance and also confidence. Sure. Sometimes it's really scary. I'll never forget the day I got the phone call that we delivered 750,000 garments to a retail customer, and they had been made in Burma. Well, apparently, for that particular customer, Burma was a blacklisted country, and you couldn't produce there. Well, that became a true dance of, you know, it's half defense, okay, but you sent a factory certification group into the factory in Burma.
what part of it wasn't going to come out of Burma did you not understand?
And by the way, where is the blacklist? I'm happy to comply with the blacklist as I guide manufacturing across the globe. Well, we don't produce that. We don't publish that.
Okay. We'll let you know when you violated the rules. Okay.
Right after you deliver 750,000 units to our door. I mean, those are things that at the time I thought, I don't think I'm going to.
You're not going to make it.
I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm going to throw up in my trash can. Pardon the bluntness. Yep. And then I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do. But, you know, we worked it out. They ended up taking 750,000 units and said, let's just get them out on the floor and sell them out really fast before upper management notices we have them.
Right.
And heaven bless, it worked.
Good for you. So tell me about a General Sherman experience. And you'll have to tell me whether these analogies are bad. Maybe I need to come up with references other than to Civil War generals.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not at all. A General Sherman experience. A General Sherman experience for me is, for example, going into Honduras. No one understood how to do business in that country. No one understood what it took to get two plants open. They already had one. Mm-hmm. That was a very interesting experience. No one understood before they invested in this entity, for example, that Nicaragua, who is literally 10 miles away from us, had just been granted favored nation status, which meant they could actually buy all the parts for a table from us. We could ship them down to Nicaragua. They could put them together and ship them into the States tax-free because they were one of the poorest countries and still are. We, on the other hand, could keep our parts, put them together, ship them into the U.S., but we'd have every tax, every tariff, everything applied to us. And there was just no way economically. Yeah, so, I mean, that's a, we figured it out. Mm-hmm. We figured out how to get it done. We figured out how to sell around it. We figured out how to get two plants open, including enticing my husband to come down and spend three glorious weeks in Chiloma Cortez so he could prepare all the electrical wiring plans for the plant to make sure we didn't burn down.
Oh, wow.
And so when it's 110 degrees in Chiloma at 9:30 in the morning and people tell you it's a dry hot. No, they lie. It's 110 degrees, Dave.
Degrees. Yeah.
And it's only going to get hotter. I don't really care if it's dry or wet. Okay. So, those are time, you know, helping a company that I ultimately helped their family with multiple entities that they were involved in go to the multi-million dollar nine figure revenue level, help them have an equity event that went very well. It wasn't without its bumps and bruises.
Right.
Every good deal dies to at least two deaths, as you know, Dave.
You just hope it's not yours.
Exactly. So, and I know you're going to roll your eyes because you feel this is a canned answer. My most appealing successes, and there's a difference between winning and succeeding, in my opinion. My best successes that I've enjoyed the most, I can go to a file cabinet in my house, open it up, and I've retained every card that every employee that has worked with me and then moved on has sent me to say, I learned so much from you.
Wow. You never told me that before.
I have an entire box. Mm. I mean, there was one gal that, we just drove each other to distraction. That's why not every success is, you know, not win doesn't always mean succeeding. She wrote me the most lovely note when she went on to her next adventure. She said, I just wanted you to know you taught me not just about the business that went on in those four walls and how to carry it out, but you taught me about life. Mm. You taught me about how to raise my children because I have two kids.
Well, you also said there's a difference between success and winning. Mm-hmm. Define that for us so we can see where the line is. I think I know what it is, but anyway.
Well, I believe that John Goodman is the one who said that, the U.S. UCLA basketball coach, whose definition was, if you win and you do it in such a poor manner, and this is something we used to talk a lot about around our executive management tables or middle management tables. If you win at the expense of being brutal, that's, you may win, but when you fall asleep at 2 a.m, do you consider it a success?
That's good.
Do you feel good about it?
Yeah.
Either when you fall asleep or when you wake up and you can't get it off your mind. So sometimes it's the manner in how things are handled.
Yeah. It's John Wooden you're thinking of.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
No, it's all good. Yeah, it's kind of like winning could be dollars and cents. Success is the impact you made along the way. Be good, bad, or indifferent.
And I would say the other thing that was definitely a general customer for me, which consistently and still remains one, is when the team makes so much progress and then something new is inserted into it or someone new. And they have a tendency to pit people together. And we've all seen those personalities. Mm-hmm. We start going backward.
Mm-hmm.
And to spend so much time building trust among each other, training middle management people so they're ready to go to the next level, and have somebody come in and turn it to a toxic environment, that's a General Custard moment for me.
Okay. In that case, it's a General Custard, as in the pudding.
Yeah, that's a I don't know what I did wrong here moment. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's not what you did wrong.
I think to your point, a lot of times people self-reflect that they had really more of a input on the outcome of events than they do. I mean, sometimes you have to look at it for what it is. And maybe you're not that good when you succeed, and you're not that bad when you don't.
Yeah. Well, you've counseled me personally many a time over 25 years, Dave, telling me that same thing. My very favorite quote from you is, advice is only good if people want to hear it, Aggie.
that goes to my friend Jim Stacy, who taught me that one. You have seen a lot of success, growth in companies and in people. Have you found mergers and acquisition has helped them along the way to achieve some of their goals?
I say it's the other way around. We need to help right. them be successful in order for them to have a good merger or acquisition.
Very good. Yes.
It's completely the other way around. And I know
I agree.
You and I have discussed this lightly a couple of times. Gosh, it's really hard for me to call it a merger or an acquisition because somebody's buying somebody.
Exactly. At the end of the day. So for our audience, if you were to give two or three bullet points of advice, what would it be?
Well, I think one of the most important things that I have learned, and it took me a while for Paul Burns and Paul Bertrand of Tarsus CFO to get me to really deeply comprehend this. The sooner you start the process of improving your company and getting people trained inside of the environment and, you know, having internal audit people audit different departments, you make the company better. And all that does is increase your multiple when you go to sell. So when you're the first time you're at the coffee table with your family on a Saturday morning and you start discussing, selling, mm-hmm. you know, an equity event, that's the time to start because that process is very long. Mm-hmm. It's in order to get the best multiple, you don't decide on February 1st to sell and then cash out by June 15th.
Right.
I guess you could, yeah. but it's rare and you won't get the multiples that you could get for your family. So that'd be the first thing. The second thing kind of goes back to who you're surrounding yourself with. I think it's important when you go through an equity event, and we like to call them equity events. When
right.
you go through an equity event, to make sure you surround yourself with outside people who have a lot of experience in it and who can really help you. You know, you need the Dave Siders who have merger and acquisition experience that can look at your buy-sell agreement and you know, look at the disclosures you're making. And you need a Tarsus type group who has a tremendous amount of experience in equity events and can say, okay, now don't forget, we need to check all of our maintenance records. We need to be prepared. If maintenance isn't up to snuff, that's going to cost money. We need to be prepared to the benefit of how much of a lifestyle support has the company supported so far for the family, you know? Everybody has a car. Everybody's going to, you know, Hawaii for the industry retreat. Well, those are all things you can add back
right.
to increase the EBITDA of the company so
right.
that you don't just bury those in there. And it became habit for me when I was working with a small entrepreneur or even a middle market entrepreneur. Even if there was no conversation about an equity event, I began to keep track. Because if 2 years from now I needed it, I did not want to have to go dig it all back up. It's a lot
right.
easier to do it on the front end yes. than it is on the back end. And I think the third thing that I have seen, if I pick three, the third thing is you have to decide who on your internal team you're going to bring into the fold. Who's going to be under the tent? Because you can't do it all on your own. You've got to have people who are discreet, but yet have enough knowledge of the overall business. Because honestly, Dave, entrepreneurs are busy. You're not busy. They're not worried. They're very busy. Entrepreneurs are looking at the next dot and the next dot and the next dot. And I would not expect any one of them that I worked with to be able to click a couple of buttons and figure out what our production capacity that we have left to sell is. I would expect them to go down the hall or pick up the phone and say, hey, how much capacity do we have next month or the month after? You know, what do we need to get on and what do we need to address? So there's going to be a lot of questions that will be asked. I mean, we both know a diligence list is a typical diligence list is 200 lines long. Well, that's going to take more than one person. So you've got to figure out who you're going to bring in the tent or under the tent, how you're going to get this executed. Because, and that's why I'm such a big believer and supporter in outside professionals, getting your outside professionals chosen and picked, because your management, they're running a business every day.
Right.
They don't have time.
Over and over again. Right.
Yeah. And you wear them out. You stress them out. You stress their families out. And sooner or later, your spouse gets tired of you showing up at 11:30 at night every night.
Well, when you're running a business going through an M&A, you've got your own two businesses, essentially. The one
exactly.
that you have yeah. had and the one you're not going to have any longer. And I've just seen people get worn out. What's next for you professionally and personally in your life?
Well, I love this space. I love working with the Tarsus boys, and I am going to give this shout out to them because, you know, as you might guess, between Saudi Arabia and Honduras and Costa Rica, I'll never forget the time I had to go to Costa Rica for a week and everybody kept telling me to watch out for the pirates. And I kept thinking, I'm going to see Johnny Depp. No, they meant the thugs on the bus. Watch out for the thugs on the bus. I've seen my fair share of what I call crazy. I've seen some crazy. I've seen some things that did not necessarily match my value system, and that those were the first moves normally to make me want to go somewhere else. Within the Tarsus organization, you never have to worry about that, ever, Dave. I've been there 12 years, and every single solitary time, they have come down on the side of, we're going to do what's right for our client, and then internally come down on the side of, we're going to do what's right for the people who are part of our team.
That can't be said universally.
No, it can't be.
And industry,
So I really love this space, but I've also become very involved in higher education projects.
Which is represented by
Well, your position. I'm on the board of trustees for Avila University.
Right.
We have moved our entire master's program to online because as we were listening to our master's students, they said, you know, I really want this, but I've got a family, I'm working full time, I gotta get the kids to soccer practice, all those sorts of things.
Right.
So we moved the program to online. One of the things that we are doing is what we're calling Eagle Talks, little 7 to 10 minute clips. I was assigned to go find 5 topics and then sit down and do the talks, to which I smiled sweetly and said, I can walk into a boardroom and talk to people, Dave. I can walk out on the plant floor and I'll be talking what kind of purse girl who's running the machine carries. But to sit in front of a camera, it's just not my thing. So I smiled sweetly and said, can I bring participants with me? I mean, if I can recruit some people, you know, entrepreneurs, a couple entrepreneurs I have coming, I have a couple of people, one has his master's and the other one has decided rather than getting a master's, he's going to get different certifications. They're all coming. We've all had meetings. We've all come up with topics and subtopics. And yeah, we're going to arrive on campus and record these sessions, and there they go. They'll be required. You'll be required to watch however many, because there's a lot, you know, several different people, not just me.
Right.
You'll be required to listen to however many of them, and then go to the blackboard or chalkboard, blackboard, and make your comments and things of that nature. So I'm doing that. I'm on the learning environment committee. I'm doing some work with some high schools, some trade schools, actually.
Well, I heard Biden's calling you. He'd like you to figure out the Ukraine. Are you up for that?
Oh.
I mean, I don't think you're doing enough, you know? I think you need to do a few more things.
I think someone to be remain unnamed is interested in bringing back the USSR together. So I'm staying out of that.
I have no idea what you're talking about. There's no such problem here. I have nothing. Well, I want to thank Aggie. And Aggie, how do they find out more about you and Tarsus CFO if they were to want to contact you and your company?
Sure. Well, you know, clearly you can go to the website, but I can be emailed at acooper@tarsuscfo.com, or you can look at my LinkedIn page. Mm-hmm. The other two people right now that are really, really active because the company has seen good growth, Ben Olson. He can be you can look at his web page. He's Olsen. And my little buddy, John Longan, he's been with Tarsus longer than I've been with Tarsus. And his last name is Longan. So you can look at LinkedIn pages. You can, all of our email addresses are first initial last name @tarsuscfo.com.
So I want to thank Aggie for her time today, and you'll be able to see this on the website for davidsider.com and on my LinkedIn page and YouTube. Thanks to Aggie.
No problem.
If you're in search of assistance, go to davidsider.com and schedule a free consultation. Also, make sure to subscribe to the show, rate it, leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, and Aggie, you can reach this podcast on Spotify, on Apple, and the media folks have found some other places. So they're out and about, as they say, in Canada. And you should be able to learn so much from these podcasts, and in particular from good people like Aggie Cooper. So thank you, Aggie.
My pleasure.
Until next time, God bless everyone. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every person or business. In determining the best course of action, business owners should consult with their attorney on their distinct circumstances.